Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, an eyewitness update on events and conditions in Syria, as well as a look at Trump's recent statements in Saudi Arabia and Israel, and why it will only further destabilize the Middle East. The truth. Vanessa Beely, that's B-E-E-L-E-Y, is a British investigative journalist who is focused on the conflicts in the Middle East, particularly in Syria, Gaza, and Yemen. She's an associate editor of 21st Century Wire and was a member of a peace-finding mission to Syria and organized by the U.S. Peace Council. She was in Aleppo during and after its liberation and after the city had been captured for almost 5 years by Western-backed Salafist terror organizations last year. She's credited with having exposed the fraud behind the faux charitable volunteer organization, the Syrian Civil Defense, or better known as the White Helmets, which was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize and was featured in the documentary that recently received an Oscar award. She is also a contributing writer to the global campaign to return to Palestine, The Dissident Voice, and manages the website The Wall Will Fall in London, where she blogs about her travels and reports the Middle East. She just recently returned to Paris from Damascus, where she was doing investigative research. Her websites are thewallwillfall.org and 21stcenturywire.com. Nice to have you with us today, Vanessa.
Hi, Gary. It's really nice to be back with you.
I want to begin with just a very general summary before we go into specific details about the White Helmets and the recent U.S. attacks on Syrian government forces and facilities, as well as Trump's recent visit to Saudi Arabia and Israel. But first, please, you just returned from Syria. What is life like there right now? Is anything different than when you were there earlier and when you were in Aleppo? And has the popular support for Assad changed at all? Is he more or less popular? What does the average Syrian citizen feel about the U.S. interference in Syria and its support for radical Islamic factions there? The forum is yours. Take your time.
Hi, thank you, Gary. Well, I mean, it's been a very interesting return to Syria. I went back at the beginning of April and I stayed for another month. Part of that time, I was able to return to Aleppo to continue predominantly my investigations into, as you quite rightly say, the NATO and Gulf state-funded White Helmet organization, which of course is funded by exactly the same regimes in the West and in the Gulf states that are funding the terrorist factions, also the extremist factions inside Syria. So that's a very important point to make. But my return to Aleppo was an interesting one because I've always professed that Aleppo is in effect a microcosm of the Syrian conflict as a whole. We saw Aleppo being divided along externally imposed sectarian lines. We saw the invasion, as you quite rightly say, of Salafist extremist factions, over 50 brigades of splinter factions and different gangs of extremists being funded and armed by different countries, by different entities within those countries, as explained to me by many of the residents that I met with in December 2016 and during my time, this time in April and early May. What I saw very clearly, and I saw even the beginning of this in December when I was there at Christmas time, so after the liberation, what I saw, which is extraordinary to actually witness it, is when those terrorist factions are, if you like, cleansed from those areas, so from East Aleppo. And when I say cleansed, I'm not talking about violently in the final moments. In fact, they were evacuated under the protection of the Syrian Arab Army and its allies, according to the Syrian government amnesty and reconciliation agreements. So these terrorist factions who had been fundamentally imprisoning Syrian civilians in East Aleppo for over 4.5 years and on a daily basis firing mortars, explosive bullets, sending suicide bombers, targeting children with sniper fire in West Aleppo, killing over 11,000 civilians, by the way, in West Aleppo during that 4.5 years, were allowed to leave with their weapons and with their families and to relocate to the area of their choice, in fact. And this is the reconciliation agreement that is offered to all of the Syrian fighting factions within Syria. So this is, again, something that is not highlighted in Western media or by our governments. The Syrian government attempts to, let's say, break the cycle of violence within Syria, despite the fact that that cycle has been created and is being maintained, fueled by our own governments, as opposed to the Syrian government itself, from what I've seen inside Syria. So what I actually witnessed was a colossal rebuilding process that started almost immediately upon liberation and has then progressed from there. So I went back actually to an Aleppo that had been cleaned, that had been completely sort of, renovated to a large extent from the damage that was done to it by these various terrorist factions and by the battles to drive those factions out of East Aleppo. I saw the peoples coming together. Again, this sectarian narrative that is very much fed to us by Western media is false. I saw Muslim sects of all sects coming together to work on the rebuilding process inside Aleppo. I saw Christians returning to their homes. I saw businesses. Of course, Aleppo was the industrial center of Syria, very much so. And in the early days, we can't forget that those terrorist factions dismantled, destroyed much of the industrial sector, including over 3,000 factories, and stole them and relocated them, reestablished them on Turkish soil. So we saw definite drives to encourage businessmen, industry to come back to Aleppo. Of course, they're still struggling with certain elements, getting medicines into town via the various terrorist checkpoints is difficult. The water supply was cut off by ISIS factions to the north of Aleppo. So there were still obstacles to overcome, but what we saw were people working together to overcome those obstacles. What was particularly interesting for me was to be able to freely go back into East Aleppo and to survey the White Helmet centers in four districts of East Aleppo. So in Sahur, in Bab al-Nereb, in Marje, and in Sukri. And again, what this clearly demonstrated to me, not only through the documentation that we found within those centers, was the very clear fact that Nusra Front and the White Helmets were one and the same. That the White Helmet centers were more often than not inside the Nusra Front compounds, or actually sharing the same building. From witness testimony, we heard that the White Helmets and Nusra Front and the various other extremist factions worked hand in hand to both imprison, to execute, to torture, and to deprive the civilian population of East Aleppo during that 4.5 years. So this was an incredibly important element of my being able to go back to East Aleppo at this time and to be able to freely move around those areas without, of course, the threat of the IEDs, the grenades, the booby traps that had been left behind by those terrorist factions, despite the fact that they were being evacuated peacefully under the Amnesty and Reconciliation Agreement. They still left behind them these deadly traps for the civilian population that would be returning to their homes. Those mines and IEDs were cleared predominantly by Russian sappers, who I think worked over, I can't remember the thousands of hectares that they covered, to basically demine much of Aleppo. Then going back to Damascus, which just prior to my arrival, had witnessed, let's say, an insurgence of the terrorist factions from Jobar and Kabun to the east of Damascus, who had actually tunneled to Abbasin Square and attacked the Syrian Arab Army at that point, threatening to break through the Syrian Arab Army defenses and to enter Damascus city itself. So there had been a number of days of fierce battles to drive back those terrorist insurgents. And so I arrived literally at the tail end of those battles and those attacks. And actually, just before I left Damascus, the area of Kabun, which is just to the north of Jobar, Kabun and Jobar are responsible for the majority of the mortar attacks on civilians inside Damascus. And again, you know, we need to ask ourselves, if this were a grassroots revolution for real, why are these so-called rebel factions or freedom fighters, as they're described by Western media, predominantly attacking civilians, children, schools, hospitals, civilian areas in all the cities where they are embedded or where they are besieging those cities or where they are occupying those cities? It is the civilians who are the main targets. So that, to me, undermines the entire narrative that this is some sort of grassroots noble battle against an evil regime and its army. The fact that they are targeting civilians. We went to Al Rabwe, which is an area just at the base of the presidential palace, along the banks of the river, where all of the families from all sectors of society go on a Friday to celebrate it being a Friday and to sit together as families to play with the children and to spend the evening there. Again, a few weeks before we arrived, a suicide bomber that had, they'd attacked the courthouse in Damascus, and they had then also, another bomber had detonated himself in that area, so among all the families of Damascus. When I went to that area on a Friday night, literally weeks after this attack, and saw the Syrians who were determined to continue their lives, to continue celebrating the diversity of their culture, the diversity of their society and their secular state, their homeland, which for them has been this cradle of such diversity for their entire lifetime. When I saw them coming together determined to overcome the fear of that suicide bombing and to come together in celebration on a Friday again to continue the traditions of their society and their culture, this is Syria. And this is what Syria represents, not only for the Syrian people, but for us as outsiders, to see this level of unity and cohesion between the Syrian people, standing not even so much behind the Syrian government, but standing behind their own identity, refusing to capitulate to the Western objective of imposing upon them an Islamic state that would tear apart the fabric of this society. The very unity, the very secularism that I witnessed would be destroyed. This kind of celebration, this kind of tradition would no longer exist. So it is very much that what they are fighting for. And that is why I think the level of their resistance to foreign intervention has been sorely underestimated. The Syrian government is, if you like, I perceive it as the cement that is holding this society together. But that society existed before this government was in place. And the people are just simply right now refusing to capitulate or to give in to external pressure, which is how they perceive it, to change their society, to change their way of life, and to change their belief in their own societal structure.
I appreciate that overview. When you were last on this program, you presented your eyewitness evidence and research about the charitable organization the White Helmets and their deep ties with U.S.-supported and funded al-Qaeda-related groups such as al-Nusra. Now, you just briefly touched upon that, but since your return to Syria, you've uncovered further evidence that now irrefutably connects the White Helmets with al-Nusra, and they're being funded by the United States and United Kingdom. So please go back to that for a little more in-depth and also summarize the evidence to support that al-Nusra is a Salafist terrorist organization very similar to what you find in Saudi Arabia and funded by Saudi Arabia. In addition to that, I want to read something that is not going to be commented on the liberal radio. This is from Black Agenda Report. And I have a radio program from Glenn Ford and Bruce Dixon and other leading black leaders and journalists called the Black Agenda Report. Here's what Ann Garrison from Black Agenda Report has to say. Peace activists confront Amy Goodman on biased Syria coverage. Quote, Amy Goodman, host of the Pacifica Network's flagship news hour, Democracy Now!, is on a speaking tour of the country to celebrate the show's 20th anniversary. When she appeared in Berkeley, East Bay Veterans for Peace, Chapter 162, were outside the First Presbyterian Church beforehand to distribute copies of their open letter to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! We need better and more diverse coverage on Syria. Dissident Voice has published the essay, and I spoke with Daniel Borgstrom, a former U.S. Marine, who wrote it for this vet group. And then it goes on to talk about what they had to say. And finally here it says, on rare occasion, journalists did actually ask us and give us good coverage, but that was very rare, because what we had to say wasn't part of their official story that the mainstream media was there to tell. And then it goes on to say, on one occasion, about 15 of us were arrested for occupying an Air Force recruiting office, and the mainstream media reported a whole lot of data about us, our names, our ages, etc., but not the fact that we were ex-GIs. I still have the newspaper clippings of that. He goes on to talk about the media has been extremely biased since the Vietnam War and what they will cover and won't cover. And they're all disappointed with Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! Quote, so we owe a lot of our current opposition to U.S. wars to coverage you've heard on Pacifica's KPFA, Berkeley, including Democracy Now! I listen to KPFK almost daily, and it's been really important in helping me to keep up on events in a rapidly changing world. But then it comes to Democracy Now!, and they're not liking what they're hearing. And so they go on to say that, quote, the warmongers in Washington, and that includes a lot of Democrats as well as Republicans, seem determined to pick a fight with nuclear-armed Russia. Many progressives seem totally blind to the danger, and Amy Goodman, Democracy Now! Is among them. Syria looks like a serious danger spot where the U.S. military forces could literally clash with Russian forces. The warmongers in Washington seem determined to use the story of Assad bombing his own people with chemical weapons, specifically sarin gas. The mainstream media plays that story big time, and Amy Goodman echoes it on Democracy Now! She features guests who promote the story, allowing them to give one-sided coverage without convincing evidence to back up their claims against Assad. She mostly ignores investigators with evidence to the contrary. People like Theodore Postol of MIT or the Veterans Intelligence Professional for Sanities, who looked at this and reported finding no convincing evidence that Assad was using sarin gas, but the terrorists were. Would you address these issues? Because it was on Democracy Now! That the White Helmets were praised. Their film was uncritically applauded, and that was true for almost all the liberal press, and it went on to win an Academy Award for, I think, short documentary. And all the media, both liberal and mainstream media, has been supportive and positive about the White Helmets. So the question is this, is that realistic based upon your findings? And what does it say when a leading voice of the liberal community in the United States supported the attack in Libya, regime change there, and supported regime change in Syria. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, I think your assessment is extremely pertinent regarding Amy Goodman. And I'd also like to make the point that when both myself and Ava Bartlett were in Aleppo in December, well, in fact, Ava was there just before me in November 2016, and I was then in Aleppo during December 2016. It was proposed to Democracy Now! That Ava or myself or both of us actually come on to Democracy Now! To talk about what was really happening on the ground, which for most independent media outlets should have been an opportunity not to be missed, to actually speak to people that were on the ground during a time when there were very few mainstream media pundits actually in Aleppo during that entire period. And basically, despite sort of having, let's say, very superficial conversations with us, during which actually getting onto the White Helmet, one of the producers actually said to me, well, basically, my vision of the White Helmets did not concur with the mainstream narrative on the White Helmets, and that was it. So there was no attempt to, let's say, investigate or to dig deeper into both the funding, the creation, the working ethics or lack of them of the White Helmets by Democracy Now. So, you know, yeah, this was, I think this was a huge disappointment for many progressives who had grown up with Democracy Now! As being one of the very few progressive independent media outlets in the early days, let's say. But I think if we look at their record during many of these interventions, we've already seen prior to Syria a clear indication of, let's say, where their priorities lie in reporting, in sticking to a narrative that basically supports interventionism and supports imperialism. So not a huge surprise, but I think still a huge disappointment for many. Now, going back to the White Helmet, as I said, one of the main reasons for my returning to Aleppo, and particularly to East Aleppo, was that despite the fact that in December I was obviously on the ground during the liberation and I was able to speak to the civilians who were emerging from that 4.5 year imprisonment under Nusra Front, terrorist, extremist rule, supported by the White Helmet. That was made very clear by the testimonies that I gathered from all the districts of East Aleppo in December 2016, that for the majority, if not for all the civilians that I spoke to, the White Helmets were described as Nusra Front civil defense. They were described as working primarily for the terrorist factions. They were described as not helping civilians. In fact, many of them described them as thieves. They described the fact that if they were injured or if they were any difficulty, the White Helmets would be there and would be stealing their belongings, stealing jewelry from dead bodies rather than rescuing them from the rubble as described. Now, let me just very quickly also go back to my early investigative work into the White Helmets, which revealed the following facts. They were not created in Syria. They were created in Turkey by a British ex-military private security expert with ties to, let's say, an arena that incorporates the very well-known private security firm that was extensively funded by the Bush administration and then given $250 million minimum by the Obama administration, which is Blackwater, who were employed by the CIA to basically carry out outreach assassination programs. And so even under the Obama administration, their employment as such by the United States deep state continued. James Lemessurier, who created the White Helmet, as I said, was an ex-British military officer
educated at Sandhurst, had been involved in many of the UK and NATO state interventions, including Kosovo, Afghanistan. If we look at the fact that the white helmets were manufactured, let's say, in 2013 in Turkey, so they cannot be called a Syrian organization, unlike the real Syria Civil Defense, which is, the parallel dimension of my investigation, is to also reveal the fact that there is an existing real Syria Civil Defense, as I call it, that was established inside Syria in 1953. It is the only Syria Civil Defense that is recognized by the International Civil Defense Organization in Geneva, which is affiliated with the Red Cross, with the UN, with the World Health Organization. Who clearly stated to me in a telephone conversation that they do not recognize the White Helmets as being a civil defense organization. The real Syria Civil Defense has also come under attack from various terrorist factions. And in some areas, such as East Aleppo, those terrorist factions that massacred crew members of the real Syria Civil Defense and stole equipment actually then morphed into the White Helmets at a later date, as described to me, not only by the crew members of the real Syria Civil Defense, but also by Dr. Bassam Hayak, who was a member of the Aleppo Medical Association based in West Aleppo, but with family in East Aleppo. So this is a very important point to make. Basically, the White Helmets were created outside of Syria. They were created with funding from Syrian opposition, from Japan, and from the United States and from the UK. Now, that funding then developed into, let's say, a consortium that has probably paid into this organization over, and this is a conservative estimate, $250 million. And that has come in basically from the United States via USAID and through their partner, Chemonix, through the UK Foreign and Commonwealth Office, through their Conflict Stability and Security Fund, for non-humanitarian aid. Now, the UK government has paid in over £65 million to date into this 3,000-strong alleged NGO, humanitarian NGO, who claims on their website to have no political affiliations and no affiliations to vested to entities that have a vested interest in the Syrian conflict. Well, almost immediately, that is rendered illegitimate as a claim when one considers the fact that the governments that are funding this organization, including EU, Qatari, Japanese governments, are also funding the various and arming, equipping, supporting and promoting the various terrorist and extremist factions inside Syria. So basically what we're seeing with the White Helmets is the creation of an organization which is, if you like, the humanitarian umbrella under which the terrorist atrocities can be committed. And what we've seen is that the White Helmets are embedded exclusively in terrorist-held areas, and particularly areas held and controlled by Nusra Front or by ISIS, so by the two, let's say, most extreme extremist factions operating inside Syria and perpetrating some of the worst ethnic cleansing programs and atrocities against the Syrian people, aided and abetted on many occasions by the White Helmets. We saw in 2015, I believe it was, they attended an execution carried out by Nusra Front in Aleppo, where they basically mopped up after the execution. They were present at the execution, did nothing to stop it. In May 2016, White Helmet operatives actually posted images of a public torture and execution of two Syrian Arab army prisoners of war in Khan Tuman in Aleppo. That was May 2016. And more recently, in the last couple of weeks, actually, the White Helmets were filmed cheering and celebrating the execution of a civilian by extremist factions. I believe it was in Idlib, this time, or no, sorry, it was in Dada. So we saw very recently the White Helmets involved and celebrating another extrajudicial execution under the auspices of Sharia law, which of course is an extremist ideology form of judiciary process. And it's certainly not something that we should be promoting or allowing any sort of humanitarian, in inverted commas, NGO to be participating in. Added to which, of course, the White Helmets have traditionally produced the propaganda that has then facilitated or enabled greater intervention inside Syria. There has been a propensity of false flags that has been, let's say, created by the White Helmet. I would recommend anybody to study the Swedish Doctors for Human Rights investigation into the Samin alleged chlorine gas attacks in March 2015, which elicited tears from a closed session at the UN instigated by then Ambassador, US Ambassador Samantha Power. The Swedish doctors have pointed out in their reports that it is highly possible that the White Helmets, again, working alongside Nusra Front or affiliated extremist groups, certainly misused children as props in war propaganda. And that is putting it very conservatively. The methods that were used to, again, in inverted commas, save the lives of these children, according to the doctor's evidence from Swedish Doctors for Human Rights, would have effectively killed those children had they not already been dead. So there is a mounting, archive of evidence against the White Helmets that is not being investigated by either mainstream media or by governmental organizations or by watchdog organizations. It appears that the White Helmets are immune to any sort of investigation other than from the independent media circles who are exposing them on an almost daily basis and at every level. I mean, at social media level, we're seeing many of, let's say, the Twitterati and the Facebook voyeurs daily putting out images of the White Helmets carrying arms, fighting alongside Nusra Front, celebrating alongside Nusra Front, and participating in Nusra Front and affiliated extremist faction atrocities. Now, this was further evidenced by what I found when I went back to the districts of East Aleppo where the White Helmets had been working and operating. When I went to the main White Helmet center, which was in the Sahur region of East Aleppo, what I saw was quite astounding. One, what I saw was the M10 hospital, which Western media had claimed had been destroyed. The hospital was still standing. But that M10 hospital had clearly been used by the terrorist factions, by Nusra Front. It had been taken over by Nusra Front, and it had been used only to treat terrorist fighters. Next door to the M10 hospital was the Nusra Front headquarters in that area, which was a school that had been requisitioned by Nusra Front. And this was a common occurrence. Out of the 500 schools in East Aleppo, 300 were taken over by the various terrorist factions because, of course, one, the buildings were large. They had basements which could be used as prisons, as torture chambers, as courtrooms, as ammunition dumps, and all of this I saw with my own eyes. But, of course, they could also be protected in the sense that the terrorists, as they did, could put out the narrative that the Syrian and Russian government were bombing schools, which, of course, they were, but they were no longer schools that were being used to educate children. They were schools that were being used as terrorist centers. Now, within the compound of the Nusra Front and the M10 hospital was another series of school buildings, which were, in reality, the White Helmet Center, which were featured in an Al Jazeera documentary on the White Helmet. So this White Helmet compound was literally, if you can imagine it,
Okay, Vanessa, let me get you in a little different direction here. You've really done a comprehensive insight on the White Helmets, something that no other media in the United States has touched. Right. We've seen film footage of U.S. armored vehicles arriving at the Syrian border via Turkey. Now, Turkey became a member of NATO in 1952. Is it your belief or research that NATO is in any way being mobilized to target the Syrian government forces? And what is your assessment of the Trump White House now arming Kurdish militia groups, the YPG, that operates within the anti-Assad Syrian Democratic Forces? And who are the Syrian Democratic Forces? Because my research indicates it seems like a mercenary force comprised of not only Syrians, but other Arabs, Assyrians, Armenians, Turkmen, and Kurdish groups.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen in the last week, I believe, the U.S. coalition bombing of Syrian Arab Army and allied forces near the Al-Tanf area, which is on the border with Iraq and Jordan, which was an attempt, one, to protect their assets. I've actually forgotten the name of the brigade that they were protecting. But, you know, most of the rebranding of the various militant and extremist factions, it was the Maghwir al-Thawra Brigade, actually, I've just seen it, which is still affiliated to Nusra Front. There were very few extremist brigades fighting inside Syria, funded by the United States, NATO states, and Gulf states, that are not under, let's say, the umbrella of Nusra Front, which is the most effectively armed and equipped faction, extremist faction inside Syria. So it's very difficult to disentangle one from another. And there are certainly, I would say categorically, no moderates fighting on the ground. So quite who these assets were that the U.S. coalition was protecting towards the Jordan Iraqi border when they attacked and bombed Syrian Arab Army forces. So at some point, they were attempting to slow down the Syrian Arab Army advance towards that border, because that border is critical, particularly for NATO states. The YPG, it's interesting, in fact, that Trump has now publicly declared that he is equipping and arming the YPG, because the SDF, to a large extent, was a sort of a cover-all or a catch-all for the YPG. The SDF was still, I would say, around 80% YPG. So now all that is happening is that I think Trump is publicly declaring what he's been doing and what the Obama administration was doing for some time, which is to back the Kurdish faction inside Syria that is looking for partitioning of Syria. It's looking for the creation of its own state within Syria. And, of course, that's part of the partitioning destabilization plan for Syria, which Kerry alluded to as being Plan B, which, of course, we know from Israel's perspective, the United States' other ally in this conflict in Syria, the two being Israel and Saudi Arabia, that it will benefit Israel most if Syria is basically balkanized and broken down into sectarian regions, the first of which would be Kurdistan. Also, of course, playing the Kurdistan card keeps, to some extent, Turkey under control, because it's clearly putting out the message to Turkey that unless it behaves and unless it adheres to the United States' objectives, geopolitical and otherwise, inside Syria, of course, there is the threat of the state of Kurdistan and the incorporation of the Kurdish elements inside Turkey that are a threat to Turkey's security, although quite how Turkey can possibly complain about a threat to its security when it's happily been incubating terrorism that's being infiltrated into Syria for the last 6-plus years. So, you know, it's a very complex chess game that is going on at the moment, and the U.S. is certainly using its proxies to the full. Are there NATO forces inside Syria? Yes, for sure. There are special forces inside Syria. We know that Trump instigated the invasion, which then went into Manbij. And that was immediately in the wake of the Kurdish factions inside Manbij handing over the territory to the Syrian army for their control. And almost immediately we saw the U.S. reaction, which was to invade and to ensure that the Kurdish factions maintain control of Manbij, and we know that that is now what has happened. So the YPG, in my opinion, is another proxy. It's a potentially a less extremist proxy to Al-Qaeda and ISIS and the various other extremist factions, but it's nevertheless another U.S. proxy that is being funded by and armed and equipped and promoted and supported by the U.S. It is also being supported heavily by Israel and promoted by Israel, which is a clear indicator of its use against Syria. But equally, there's still division in the Kurdish.
Vanessa, if Assad falls and there's regime change, what is likely to replace it, and what do you foresee happening in Syria? And does Assad have any chance of survival if Russia and or Iran withdraw their support, because now Trump and America's allies are threatening Iran more forcefully?
Well, I think immediately the huge danger, and this danger has been what has united the Syrian people behind the Syrian government and the Syrian army, is that if Assad were to be removed, and he would only be removed forcefully, he would certainly not be removed by popular opinion inside Syria, then we would effectively have a very familiar failed state, and we would have a very familiar vacuum which would be filled by the extremist factions that are now operating inside Syria. We would have the prospect is too horrendous to even contemplate to a large extent, because we would have mass ethnic cleansing of the minorities inside Syria that are currently under the protection of the Syrian government, not forgetting that 80% of the population, so 18.9 million within Syria, 80% of that 18.9 million are living under the protection of the Syrian government and the Syrian army in Syrian government-controlled inhabited areas of Syria. And, you know, to go very quickly back to the real Syria Civil Defense, that organization is operating within that 80% of inhabited areas, while the White Helmets are only operating in the 20% terrorist-occupied areas. So if Assad were to fall, and again, I'm not contemplating this on any level, then we would see horrendous ethnic cleansing and massacres and atrocities committed against the Syrian people and against the Syrian Arab army itself. I don't see, yes, we're seeing a lot of posturing from Trump, particularly with his speech to Saudi Arabia and his speech alongside Netanyahu yesterday. We're seeing a lot of posturing, and we're seeing a lot of hypocritical accusations being levied at Iran right now. But I think actually all that's going to do is to strengthen the alliance between Iran and Syria and even Russia, because I don't think Russia, as pragmatic as it is foolish enough to underestimate the threat that it will face should that axis of resistance be weakened in any way. And by axis of resistance, I mean Russia, Iran, Syria, and to some extent China also. And so I think actually what we're seeing, I think while immediately post-election we saw to some extent a little bit of wavering and a little bit of maneuvering for position in the new global arena with Trump, I think now what we're seeing is that he's basically aligned himself very clearly with the axis of terrorism, predominantly Saudi Arabia and Israel, and he's made it very clear the multi-billion contracts that he's discussing with Saudi Arabia, that he's not going to stop funding terrorism, and that terrorism is being used, as we know, globally to subjugate people in Yemen. Saudi Arabia is committing a genocide against against the Yemeni people with those very weapons and arms that Trump is now vamping up sales of to Saudi Arabia. So I think what we've now seen actually is a clear demarcation of the battle lines. And I think if anything, that's only going to strengthen the axis of resistance and the alliance between Russia, Iran, Syria, and China, which we might have seen wavering when Trump was, if you like, making the right noises as regards working with Russia to defeat terrorism. I think now when we see this clear alignment with terrorism by the United States administration, we will see a strengthening of that alliance inside Syria.
You know the Middle East very well, not just Syria, but Israel, Gaza, Yemen. Trump just recently lectured in Saudi Arabia this week, procuring over $110 billion in arms deals, raised his saber against Iran, and then met with Israel's President Netanyahu. There was also now a formal attack by the U.S. on Syrian government forces. Yemen is, as you mentioned, a humanitarian disaster. It's genocide. By any international standard and any treaty, Saudi Arabia and its allies, Qatar, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, are guilty of crimes against humanity. So they clearly are the new axis of evil, and yet not a word in the American media, CNN, MSNBC, the dancing clowns of American media, left and right, liberal and conservative, condemning the human rights genocide in Yemen. And yet there is the President of the United States with no context, no historical perspective, no geo-perspective, acting as if the only thing that matters is the big financial return to the United States for these arms. Now, there is a famine and starvation underway in Yemen, and the Saudis are determined to eradicate all who opposed to the Saudi regime. They have not liberated any of their views about women. Women are no better than dogs in Saudi Arabia. Gays are thrown off buildings and killed, yet you do not see that made as an issue in the American media, even by gays in the media, who should be condemning Saudi Arabia and challenging the President of the United States for why would you support a severely demented homophobic regime. The entire regime, not just a few individuals. And so what we have is we are witnessing another turn of events for increased military throughout the region. And this next aggressive action is again being completely framed by both the United States and the mainstream media as being a humanitarian effort against terrorism, which includes Iran. So in your final thoughts, focus upon what your analysis of Trump's visit to Saudi Arabia and Israel means as far as the future of Syria?
Well, I think I don't think we can actually consider what Trump's, let's say, vulgar and grotesque capitalist interests and how they are going to affect Syria without also considering last night's alleged terrorist attack in the UK in Manchester, and the fact that Theresa May had, of course, the parliament is dissolved prior to the elections in June. In 2013, the UK was prevented going to war because parliament voted against it. Now, without parliament in existence, of course, there is a very strong chance that May will push through a war coalition in reaction to the alleged terrorist attacks last night in Manchester and push for further intervention and potentially, of course, war in Syria. Now, maybe coincidentally, this coincided with Trump's visit to Saudi Arabia, with his very clear alignment both against Iran and alongside Israel. Yeah, we're seeing Trump basically aligning himself with probably two of the greatest terrorist entities on this earth, which is Israel and Saudi Arabia. Both of whom, of course, Saudi Arabia is funding, arming, and equipping the majority of the extremist factions inside Syria, and of course the arms deals that are now being signed with the United States. Many of those arms will end up in Syria or, of course, being used against the Yemeni people. At the same time, Israel, we know, has been treating the various extremist factions in Israeli hospitals before releasing them back into Syria to continue the illegal battle against the Syrian Arab army inside Syria. So both of these entities are focused on the destruction of Syria. And we've now seen very clearly that Trump has aligned himself with those two entities and very clearly profess an animosity or an antagonism towards Iran, who is an integral part of the axis of resistance within Syria. And of course, by default, against Hezbollah, which traditionally has been the nemesis of Israel as regards the Palestinian cause. And we also know that Syria has historically defended the right to return for Palestinians and the right for Palestinians to live in their own state with equal rights to the illegal state of Israel occupation and occupiers. So I think, as I said, we've seen very clear battle lines drawn up here. And I think we've seen the NATO states' military forces gathering both in Jordan on the border with Jordan and Iraq, to the northeast in Qamishli. We know that there are United States and British, at least, if not other countries, special forces in that area. The United States has illegally invaded Syria into as far as Manbij. We know that the Turkish proxies, let's say, are occupying the province of Idlib. The majority of the extremist and militant factions in Idlib are under the control of Turkey. So if you like, there is an attempt to create a peninsula of Syria within these corners that are occupied by either by NATO state special forces or by NATO state special forces and their proxies, whether that is the YPG, whether that is the various militant factions, the new Syrian army, which was established by Norway, actually, in Jordan. It doesn't matter. What it basically means is that there is a ring of hostile forces surrounding Syria. And so what we're seeing now, I believe, is the fermenting of a global war, whether it is between the UK, the US, and Russia on Syrian soil, whether it is between Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the United States against Iran. We don't know. But I think we're definitely seeing the escalation of the battle lines and the potential military escalation inside Syria. And that's where we're heading.
I believe that you are accurate. I would add one caveat.
Mm.
This president, I believe, would in a heartbeat use nuclear weapons, especially if he could be told that there was a new type of nuclear weapon that can better target, lessen the collateral damage, and also at the same time have his National Security Advisor and CIA give Israel permission to do a preemptive strike against Iran and therefore throw us into a nuclear conflict in the Middle East. Do I believe that's possible? Yes. I hope that some wiser minds prevail, but we're dealing in a city that's not just a swamp. It's a human black hole, much like in the universe, that sucks everything into it, including light. So there is no enlightenment, there's no true diplomacy, there's no detente, there is no sense of compassion for the sacredness of life of other people, other races. And in that absence, where you have a hyper war mindset on steroids, then that becomes ever more a possibility. But I thank you, Vanessa, for coming on, sharing your insights, something that the mainstream and alternative media have refused to consider. And especially enlightening is what you said when a producer for Democracy Now! Said they weren't interested in what you had to say on the White Helmets because all the other media supported one consensus opinion. Boy, does that tell us a lot about the way people perceive what journalists should be seeking. Thank you, Vanessa, for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Gary. Take care.
Vanessa Beley, B-E-L-E-Y, her websites are, for those of you who'd like to reach out, thewallwillfall.org and 21stcenturywire.com. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.